I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know Mike, but we're from the same. We got the same home. I don't know if it's your hometown. He's from Meridian, Mississippi, and I am too. So somebody thought it'd be fitting that I introduced him. And I don't know. Meridian's an interesting town, and that probably accounts for most of the reason you're an alcoholic, perhaps. But without further ado, here's Mike. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. That was a wonderful introduction. And I'm actually not from Meridian. My name's Mike Bennett. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 26, 1992. My sponsor is Clancy I from Venice, California. You guys, probably a bunch of you just heard him talk. He was up at the convention here a couple weeks ago. I'm sorry I missed that in your hospitality, but I just got a new job in Meridian, and a little too soon to take a 4 or 5 day weekend and go to Atlanta for a convention, so I wound up working through it, and my sponsor was desperately mean to me about it and told me I was a loser. And you guys laughing have the same kind of sponsorship, so you know what I'm talking about. But I've been working in Meridian through a consulting firm that I've had for the last 7 or 8 years every month for about 1 or 2 days, and recently just became a partner in a Ford Nissan dealership there, so they moved me up in April is their operating partner, so now I live in Meridian, and I think it's a wonderful town, but I never drank there, so, you know, I don't know anything about it, but thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate the invitation. It's always an honor to talk at an AA meeting. I did not used to feel that way. You guys mind if I move your stuff? Good. Thank you. I didn't used to feel that way. I had a friend when I was pretty young. About 20 years old, and I had a friend that just drank with me, drank the way I did. He was definitely an alcoholic of that, I'm sure. He went, his wife threw him out of the house. He had a couple of kids, and I had a kid. His wife and my wife were friends, and his wife threw him out of the house because of his drinking. And I was drinking the same way, but he was kind of puny about it, you know. He snuck around, he hid his drinking, he lied about it, and she just had her fill of it. She'd been married to him longer than my wife had been married to me, so I wasn't as suspicious as him yet, and I was still at that stage of my drinking where I didn't hide it. I just drank in front of everybody, and if they didn't like it, they could just get the hell out of my house, you know. That was my opinion early on, and I thought it would be that way with all of my drinking, and I had a little disrespect for him because of his sneaking around and stuff, but he left and he went to a treatment center and got out of this treatment center after however long you go to a treatment center. At that time, I didn't know and I didn't pay attention, but he was out and he started going to some AA meetings. And him and I stayed friends, and I was courteous and didn't drink around him because I knew he had a problem. And after about, I'm going to say just a few months, he started drinking again. So that was kind of my first example of AA, you know. So this guy went to AA and then here he was drinking. After a period of time, 6 months or a year, he was in trouble at home again and had to go to another treatment center. And that time I offered to take him. So I drove him to this treatment center. This is down in Phoenix, Arizona, which is where I'm actually from. I took him to this treatment center. And when we got there, I went around the other side of my pickup to get a suitcase out of the back of the pickup. And he started to cry. And he's a grown man. He started to cry because he had to go to treatment. And I thought, man, yeah, thank you. Because I was a tough guy, you know. He would cry. And this guy, we were men, you know. And I lost a little more respect for him. And I set a suitcase on the street and drove off, you know. And thought, geez. And he got out that next time. And he was sober for a while and doing well. And he's over at my house one day. And we're doing something, just messing around out in the yard doing something and working on something. And he said, I said, what's wrong? You're just fidgeting, you know. He said, what's wrong? He said, well, I'm supposed to go to an AA meeting and I just don't feel like going. I said, man, what trouble you had? You better get your ass down there and go. You know, you need to go. And I imagine I'm 21, 22 years old at this point, drinking every day. Why I was not drinking that day, I have no idea, except maybe he got there too early and I was trying not to drink around. Because I drank pretty much every day. And anyways, I told him, well, what if I go with you? I go with you to a meeting, maybe it'd be all right. He said, okay, so, you know, I always said I was there as a supportive friend, but the truth is there might have been a little curiosity, you know. I might have just been a little intrigued.
see what was going on. I didn't consciously think that way, but looking back. So I remember we went to a school, and they had all these tables, long tables lined up, you know, and everybody sitting around it. And they just started at one end of the room. I mean, they did whatever they did to start it. I didn't retain any of it, but they went around the room and introduced themselves and talked a little bit. And I thought it was the strangest type of a gathering that I'd ever attended, the type of personal and intimate things people talk about. It was embarrassing to me, really, for them. And this dude was embarrassing. And they got to him, and he said, "My name's Van, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to pass," or something like that. I assume that was it, but he didn't talk. And then everybody's looking at me, and I said, "My name's Mike, and I'm just here to support him." And it just went on. So that was a meeting I attended. I couldn't tell you one thing that was said in it. I just knew when I left there that it didn't apply to me, that I was not an alcoholic. Whatever was wrong with those people was different than what was wrong with me, is the way I felt. Well, he wound up getting drunk again and kicked out finally for the last time. She wouldn't let him back in the house. And he was almost homeless. And his dad and mother had some money, and they probably could have put him somewhere. But I felt sorry for him, and I told him he could come to my house and stay with me. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
I didn't wear my hearing aid, so I don't have a good perception. See, we're both old. We both are fat and wear suspenders. That's why you wear suspenders when you get too fat for a belt, when a belt cuts into you. You move the suspenders. And everybody thinks it's class. You know, we have ulterior motives that way. And we wear hearing aids. We're both deaf. Can't see either. So. And we have the same line of sponsorship. I learned that Jerry's sponsor has the same sponsor as I do, Clancy. And a bunch of you guys in the room are from Clancy's line of sponsorship, so you're used to the abuse that you deserve. Right? It does toughen you up after a while, doesn't it? So, and Bob Darrell, who is Bob D., who is Jerry's sponsor, and I know each other. We're not friends. We don't know each other well, but we see each other every year somewhere around the country. Clancy and where we travel and stuff. But so anyways, I invited him to come stay at my house. But I told him, I said, "If you're going to stay at my house, and if you drink like a man, don't sneak around here and hide. You drink. And if you're going to drink, you just be a man and do it." And he said, "All right." You know, he's liking the sound of that. But I did say, "Replace my booze. If you drink five, replace it." And I started noticing that my booze was disappearing and not getting replaced. And then I asked him, "Are you drinking my booze?" And it's okay, but you need to replace it. And he started lying to me and saying he wasn't drinking it. This room he was staying in my house, I had a desk in there. And I went in there one day while he was at work to find something in this desk. And he had been crushing up all these beer cans and hiding them in the backs of the drawers. And he pulled the drawer open with the paper. There were just all these beer cans stuffed. And it was a big desk with deep drawers. And I mean, it was full of these smashed up beer cans. And I was so disgusted by that. I mean, absolutely disgusted with this man. And when he got home from work, I told him, I said, "There's something wrong with you. This is not a drinking problem. You have mental issues, and you need to get help. And I don't trust you to be in my house anymore." You know, even I threw him out of the house. And this was a good friend of mine. I mean, we've been friends for years. Drank together, raised our kids together. I threw him out of the meeting. And about 3 or 4 years later, I was probably 26 years old. So I got sober when I was 26 years old. I got sober pretty young. So I was 26 years old. I got a call from my current wife, because I was already divorced once, my current wife at that time, and his wife, ex-wife, were friends. No, that's not true. My ex-wife and his ex-wife were friends, and his ex-wife contacted my ex-wife to call my current wife to tell her he had hung himself and he was dead. And that was devastating to me, because even though I was disgusted with him, he was still my friend. But here's the thing that happened, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute, but up to that point, my drinking was getting progressively worse, and I had reached the point to where I was beginning to sneak around and hide my booze, because it was causing me so many problems at home, and not so much at work yet, because I was kind of in charge at work, and nobody really had dibs on my schedule, you know, so I could kind of sneak out for lunch and slam a couple of tall cans of beer. o'clock in 1 second. I was going to the place. Matter of fact, I got in so much trouble at home with my drinking, I had to cut a deal with my wife that was drinking so much every night that I would, originally, I said, well, I'll just drink on the weekends. So she would get off my ass. But my first wife divorced me because of my drinking. And my second wife was showing the same symptoms. So I knew that, you know, I was on the clock. So I started negotiating a deal with her that I'd only drink on the weekends. And that lasted about a day. And I realized I had overreacted. So I cut a new deal. And I cut another deal. And before the deal cutting was over, I was going to drink 2 beers and 2 glasses of brandy. Because that was my drink, was brandy. And I would just chase it with ice cold beer. And I wouldn't drink until I got home, because that was the problem. I was one of these guys, if I started drinking before I got home, pretty good chance I didn't make it home. I just, you know, sometimes just sleep in my car because I'd get home so late, I just didn't give a shit, and I just stay in my car. But it didn't take a week or so, and I realized I couldn't get home from work without drinking. So I would stop at the whatever the convenience store, and I'd get a 6-pack of O'Doul's. They didn't make that anymore.
Yeah.
O'Doul's. And I'd get 2 tall cans of Coors Light. And I'd slam those 2 cans of Coors Light in a few minutes. And then when I'd walk in the house, I'd have this open can of O'Doul's with my 5-pack, you know. And I'd be drinking that. That way, if she smelled it on me, you know, yeah, it was beer,
very smart.
Right? No question about it. I mean, that's pretty good thinking, wasn't it? I was always pretty proud of that. And then I'd go right to the bar, and I'd pour my glass of brandy, and I'd get my ice cold beer, and I'd go sit. You know, I had a glass of brandy about that big, you know, and I'd fill it about halfway up, and I'd go sit in my chair, and I'd sip on it and drink my beer. And then I'd go get my other one, and I don't know, that lasted maybe a month, and I realized it just wasn't enough booze. Even with drinking 2 tall cans of beer on the way home, which probably turned into 3 or 4, you know, who knows, and then I'd start drinking, and but I cut so many deals with her that I knew there was no more negotiation in the deal. So what I did was get a bigger glass. And I'd pour my glass of brandy and my beer, and that lasted a little while, and then I got a bigger glass. And one day, I remember standing at my bar at my house, and I'm filling up my tea glass. I swear to God, I had a tea glass. I'm filling it with brandy, and I get my beer, and I turned around, and there she is with those Al-Anon eyes that just burn right through you, you know. And I'm not knocking Al-Anons. I love Al-Anons. Matter of fact, when I die, I want to come back as an Al-Anon because they can work the steps and drink too. So anyways, I turned around, and there she is with those eyes, and I said, what? 1, 2, and I walked away. And I go to my chair, and I'm drinking my tea glass full of brandy and my beer. And some time went on, and I had even realized after a while I started being afraid that that wasn't going to be enough booze. And that's a lot of booze. So from where I sat in my chair to the kitchen was down this long hallway, and there was a bathroom and a couple of bedrooms in between. So when she would go to the bathroom, and I'm nursing my brandy, she'd go to the bathroom. I would run down the hall in my socks so she wouldn't hear me, and I'd uncork that bottle, and I would drink as much as I could possibly get down until I heard the toilet flush. I'd pop that bottle and haul ass to my chair because I knew she was going to wash her hand. I had just enough time. I had it all timed out perfectly because I was so afraid that I couldn't get through the night with that amount of drinking. So that's what my drinking had progressed into. So when I got that call that he had hung himself, here's what went through my mind. He hung himself in his barbershop, and he was hanging there 3 days before they found him. That's how bad business had gotten because of his drinking, I promise you. Nobody was coming to me in any business. But here's what I thought. I was sitting out on my steps, and I was having a cigarette, just kind of digesting this devastating news I had received about my best friend, my good friend. And he probably was the best friend I'd ever had in my life, or one of the very closest. And the only thing I could think about, I didn't really have any thought at that point of his wife and his kids and his family, because I didn't think like a normal person, you know. I was so self-centered over just how did it affect me. I remember thinking 5 years ago, the way he was drinking led to him killing himself. And 5 years later, I'm drinking the way, I thought these were glued on here. 5 years later. You guys have a lot of distractions on your plate. But 5 years later, I'm drinking like he was drinking, and I wonder if that's what's going to happen to me. And that was one of those moments of clarity that our book and the program talks about. I wondered if my destiny was to wind up killing myself because of the way I felt. And it made me seriously consider AA. But here was the problem I had with AA. My first wife told me to quit drinking because it was my problem. And because I was afraid of ruining my marriage, I stopped drinking for nearly a year. I was about 19 years old. And my drinking was so bad, we'd been married about a year, almost a year, my drinking was so bad, I was so violent when I drank. I was not one of those happy drunks that was the life of the party. I might have been that once somewhere in my life, but I damn sure was not like that as a rule. When I drank, I became a violent...
son of a bitch.
At least. But I was just one of those guys that was on the hunt. I just looked for somebody to teach a lesson to when I was drinking. And trust me, I was 146 pounds. I took a lot of ass whoopings teaching people lessons. Didn't slow me down anymore. None of my friends would drink with me because they were always having to defend me and protect me and get out of trouble that I caused because I was just a terrible, terrible person. But anyway, so I quit drinking for a year. But if you're new, and I assume there's a lot of new people in the room because I've talked to a few people that have recently got out of treatment. Just at the door. Here's what happened to me when I quit drinking. I got better in the beginning. After a few days, and I could stomach some food, and I started sleeping again, and I would bathe, and I started feeling better. So after a few days, I was better. But after any substantial period of time, I would start to get a little bit worse. I would get a little bit unhappy with my reality, and start to get a little bit of anxiety. And it would start to build into a little fear and a little bit of paranoia and a little bit of frustration. And then that would turn into being short with people. And before long, I'm snapping at everybody. And then it would just turn into anger and then eventually rage. And that's the way I got when I got sober. And I could only do that so long before eventually I could not stand living in my own skin. I just couldn't stand it. I hated me, and I hated you, and I hated everything in the world, and everything that it stood for. I just hated being alive. The only answer that I ever knew was to take a couple of drinks. And after a couple of drinks, I would start feeling better again. So I knew that drinking was not my problem. Drinking was my solution to my problem. My problem was being sober. Well, after about a year, I started drinking again because of that, what I just described. I was so unhappy, sober. And she divorced me. You know, we went and had another year or so of fighting, and she just had enough. We had a baby, and she was not going to raise this baby with a drunken lunatic around. And I was one of those guys that would slam doors and knock them off the hinges. I'd slam them so hard and throw coffee cups across the house. I never beat her up or hit her, but I was abusive in the way I talked to her and raising my voice and yelling and breaking shit. And I was just a tantrum thrower. You know, I was a big 10-year-old. That's what I was when things didn't go my way. So eventually, she just divorced me and had all she could stand. And we didn't have any money. I was a horseshoer back then. I grew up in South Phoenix not the ghetto necessarily, because that's kind of downtown, but we were out on the edge of town. But I grew up in a really bad poor part of town. And matter of fact, my brother and I, who I still talk to today, my brother and I would stand in our yard when we were little kids, and we'd look across the field and railroad tracks to the projects, and we would wonder, and he would say to me, how come we don't get to live there in the project? That's how poor we were. When I was about 12 years old, I got in so much trouble. My brother and I had been in so much trouble. He was a part of a Hispanic gang in South Phoenix, a little bit older than me. And I was hanging around, you know, I didn't really do anything. I wasn't a criminal yet, I was too little. He was a criminal. I just ran around with them, and they were carrying guns and knives and breaking in the house and all that stuff. And I just ran around with them when I could get out of the house. I was just a little kid and looked up to my brother. But we got in so much trouble. About 11 years old, my dad got me out of juvie for the last time. And my brother had already been in a boys' home twice by then. And he moved us out of town. So we moved up to northern Arizona, where we were kind of out in the country, and he thought if he got us out of the city, it might help, and it probably saved my life. It really probably did, because if we stayed in that city, there's no telling what would happen. Anyways, I started working around these cowboys and ranchers and stuff, and started learning about horses, and by the time I was 14, 15 years old, I'd learned to put shoes on horses, you know, just trim them up and nail shoes on them. So I got pretty good at that. When I was 18, 19 years old, I moved back to Phoenix and started my own business shoeing horses, of course. But here's the way I say that, as though I had a business and an income. But what happened is I'd go down there and just be a ball of fire in the beginning and get a bunch of business built up, and then I'd start drinking at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and not get to the last two or three horses I had scheduled, and then a little while longer, I'd start drinking at 2 o'clock and not get to the last two or three, and then by a while goes by, I'd start drinking at lunchtime and not get to the last four or five, you know, and then before long, I didn't have any business. So most of the time, I could drink whenever I wanted because I self-employed. And I just didn't work at all. So anyway, we didn't have any money because I wasn't working, was the point of that story. So, and she didn't care. She was driving a shuttle van for a company out at one of the nuclear plants, just hauling people back and forth the nuclear plant. So we didn't have any money. And she didn't give a shit. She said, I would rather be poor and broke and have no help and no financial assistance than to be married to you. And she meant it. Anyway, so she divorced me, and I got married a couple of months later. This is what we do. I met this girl in a bar and just fell in lust with her and didn't even know her that well. And within a few months, we were down at the ex-wife's, which wasn't an ex-wife, we were down at her house. And the new girlfriend, who I was getting ready to marry, watched the baby while we ran down to a notary to get the divorce paper signed, which she couldn't send to me because she didn't know where I was. You know, nobody knew where I was. I just showed up one day and she had them. So we signed the divorce papers and I got married to the other girl not long after that, probably before the papers were filed, in all honesty. Because my drinking just was out of control. And it's far more important than being a good husband and a good dad and, you know, doing all the right stuff. Drinking was far more important than that to me. Far more important to me than that at that stage of my life. Now, as time went on, I did look back on that with a lot of guilt and remorse. Now I know that I felt horrible about it because nobody wants to be a terrible dad. Nobody wants to. Nobody wants to be a failed husband. Not really. Sometimes we look like it, because I was a tough guy and told her, you know, you're lost. I'll just go drink the way I want now, you know, and I just kind of blew it off like it didn't mean anything to me. I think it was emotionally very devastating to me. Anyways, I married this other girl, and we were partying, and she drank. Wife number one didn't drink, and I knew that was part of the problem, because she didn't really understand how good drinking was, and she just wouldn't touch it. And so wife number two, she was a cocktail waitress, and she's partying every night, you know, after work. And I thought, that's the cure right there, is to get somebody that understands that lifestyle, and we'll be fine. And we weren't fine. It was just a horrible train wreck. But we stayed married about 2 or 3 years when I got that call. And in that 2 or 3 years we were married, I had already stopped drinking two more times because I was so violent with her that if I didn't quit drinking, she was going to leave me. And because I carried around that subconscious remorse and guilt about that first failed marriage, I didn't want to do it again, so I made an effort and I quit drinking. And I stayed sober for about 6-7 months. And the same thing happened. Started out pretty good. You know, being sober is all right. And I was going to work every day, feeling good, wasn't throwing up, because by that time I started to throw up every morning so I could choke down something, you know, to calm me. But I always had to kind of get everything out of my system first. And so I wasn't doing that anymore, and I started to eat and sleep, and I was feeling better physically and happy for a little while. And then the pressure was on being a responsible person and bringing home a paycheck and trying to pay the bills. And by that time, I had a job because I was no longer self-employable. I was more trustworthy to be on my own, so I got a job. And I actually had moved to Washington State from Arizona with this woman because her parents were up there, and I could milk them out of a pretty good job, and I did. And I was also dodging alimony and child support from the first one, so Washington State looked pretty good. I didn't know if they could find me up there, and they didn't for a long time until I got sober. So anyways, I moved to Washington State, and I'm working up there for her parents, and got sober so I could make a good impression on them and keep her from kicking me out. Because she was kind of moving back home to her parents, and I talked her into taking me with her if I got sober. And And I milked it for a while, but after a period of time, with the pressure of life and being a good person, I started feeling those same feelings again. I started feeling like, you know, it's just nobody would do things the way I wanted them to do them, and things weren't going right. And if everybody would just shape up, and, you know, I just started getting irritable and a little cranky, and before long I was angry, and then I was just full of rage, and I was just a maniac sober. And she even said to me one time, "Jesus, just have a drink. I'd rather have you drunk than have you like this, you know." And of course, she didn't know the devastation of that statement, and she regretted that later. But anyways, I finally did. I gave in, started drinking, you know, and a couple of years of that same kind of crap, you know, just sobriety being unacceptable, and drinking got unacceptable, and that's so bad. The last time that I quit drinking, that I quit drinking when I got that call that he'd hung himself, and I thought to myself, well, maybe I'd try AA. But the only thing I could think about when I was thinking about AA, because I worked with a guy at that point that had been, his dad had been sober about 35 years, and he talked to me about my drinking a couple of times. And so I thought about AA, but I thought, well, hell, AA can't work, for one, because I looked at my friend Van going in and out of AA and treatment centers for several years, and he killed himself. And I had this cousin who had been going in and out of AA all of my life. Never went to a meeting with him or talked, but here was what was wrong with him. When he got sober and started going to AA, he got religion. And he preached at everybody in the family, and everybody just, you know, shunned him. They didn't want him around because he got heavy religion. And he would stay sober for 6 months, a year, and get drunk. Stay drunk, and he was just a slobbering town drunk type of drunk. Disgusting. And then he would finally get in enough trouble, he'd get sober again and go to AA and get religion. And this just went on and on for years and years. Matter of fact, he died a few years ago, still drunk, never did get sober. He's up in his 70s, never did get sober, did that his entire life in and out of AA. So he was my only other example of AA. And it looked like it, you know, how in the hell could AA do any good for him? Because those two examples were both lousy examples of the success of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dan even told me one time, my cousin Dan, he even said to me one time, because when my first wife divorced me, I went to Dan's house to get him to go drinking with me. And when I came to your house to get you to go drinking with me, we packed a bag, literally. It wasn't about just going out for a few drinks. So we're in Dan's bedroom, he's packing a suitcase, literally, because we're going to go out drinking. And his wife hated me. You could just imagine, she hated seeing me come. And when they're packing his bag, and Dan picks up the big book on his nightstand. And he had been drinking already. I didn't take him back out. He'd already been drinking. But he had a big book. He did for years because he's been in and out of AA. Picks his big book up as we're zipping up the suitcase, and he flips it open. He looks at it for a little bit, closes it, and he said, "You know what? I don't need this, but you do." And I said, "Dan, I could never go to AA." And he said, "Why not?" I said, "Because it's religious for people who believe in God, and I don't believe in God." Because I believed at that time I was an atheist. I look back on that throughout my sobriety and realize that I never really was an atheist. I didn't really understand what that meant. But it was so much easier to say I was an atheist than to try to describe what I did think, which was I was scared and confused and I didn't know anything about it. I was 26 years old when I got sober, and I had never attended a church service. Not once ever. My parents didn't go to church, and they were not religious people. And I was put into foster care when I was about 14, and they didn't go to church. Matter of fact, he was an atheist, a self-proclaimed atheist, and they didn't go to church, so I just never went to church. And because he was an atheist, it was easy for me to say I was an atheist, and everybody left me alone. I told Dan I could never go to church, or go to AA, because it's religious, and he saved my life with this statement. He said, "Oh no, there's one whole part of AA for people who believe in God, and another part for people who don't." Now, I took that big book in his suitcase. That didn't seem like much of a statement, but I took that book in his suitcase out to my car, and I threw the book wherever I threw it. Don't know why, but when I was 26 years old and got sober and started going, hey, I still had that book. I'd never opened it or read it, but I never got rid of that book and had all kinds of opportunities, but for some reason, it just kept hanging around. You know, I never got rid of it. But Dan and I went off on our drunk, and we did our thing, and finally dropped him off, and wound up meeting wife number two, and within a few months we were married and went through that. sad story. And when I got that call that he'd killed himself, that's the only thing I could think about going to AA. One, it probably doesn't work. And two, you know, it's I remembered his religious thing, which was a real turnoff for me. But the biggest reason I couldn't go to AA is that I didn't think I was really an alcoholic. And we talked about this a little bit. Tell me your name.
Joshua.
Joshua told me that he didn't realize he was an alcoholic until somebody pointed it out to him. I realized I had a drinking problem. I couldn't drink like I'd been drinking and get sober a few times over the years and not realize I had a drinking problem. There's no doubt in my mind of that. I damn sure had a drinking problem. But I didn't think it was an alcoholic because when I got sober, my life got worse. And the only thing that ever gave me relief was taking a few drinks. It took the edge off. It took the pressure off. It quieted the voices so I could survive in this world. So I know I look like an alcoholic, and I know that you good-meaning people, well-intentioned people, think I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not really an alcoholic because I get worse when I get sober, and that's what I didn't understand, that, or I knew that people didn't understand. And I still believe that to this day, that being an alcoholic has nothing to do with drinking, really. My problems happen when I get sober. If I could drink and not have all of the trouble that comes with me drinking, I would still be drinking. There's no question in my mind because it did so much for me and made me feel so good about myself if I didn't take it too far, which I couldn't control, that there was no question I would still be drinking today if I could still get the impact that I got then. And so I just didn't understand how that could be the solution to my problem. Plus that religious thing, man, that just ate at me. So finally, I stayed sober about 4 months this time, and I was a raving lunatic. Absolutely a raving lunatic. 4 months sober. And all I could think about was him hanging in that barbershop. And I'd think about, you know, what if I just took half the money? We didn't have much money. What if I took half the money out of the bank in one of the cars, and I just disappeared? And I could just escape the whole thing. No more responsibility, none of this bullshit. But then I was able, for the first time, and I heard this later from the treatment center, but I was able to play the tape all the way to the end. But where would I go? And I thought about Seattle. Because I went on one of those, do you guys know that in Seattle they have an underground Seattle? Everybody know that? They do. And you can take a tour on underground Seattle. The problem with the tour, if you're an alcoholic, is some of the places have become dangerous and shut down, so you have to surface every once in a while. Then you go back into the underground tour, and then you surface for a little while. And the problem with the tour for a guy like me is it surfaced in front of a bar. So the tour continued, and I made a right turn into the bar, and I never got to see the rest of underground Seattle. But anyways, while I was in Seattle trying to find my tour bus later, I ran through some of the bums, you know, that were living in the alleys and the streets and stuff. And so when I was thinking this through, I could take half the money and disappear. I could just go be a bum in Seattle and just live on the street. I could sell the car. And, you know, I could live on the street. It wouldn't no big deal with me. When I was a cowboy, I camped a lot, you know. What's the difference, really? But then I realized what will happen is eventually I'll run out of money and I won't have enough money to drink. And then I'll have to get a job. And then I'll have to, you know, work, and then you have to take a bath, and a job, and have to get a place to live. And as I played the tape all the way to the end, I thought, well, shit, I'm in that position right now. How's that going to be any better? Eventually, I got to do all the same shit I'm doing now. So I just did a complete loss. I had no idea. Don't bother her for getting up in the middle of the night. She is sick. She has Drano poison. I'll explain that.
I have Drano poison.
She does. I don't know where I was. What was I talking about?
You're a bomb on the street.
You're a son of a bitch.
But it wouldn't have done any good because I'd wind up in the same boat. So what the hell am I going to do? So then I thought, and I really thought, and I was serious when I told my friend that he had mental issues. I really thought that because this wasn't just about drinking. There was something wrong with me. And what I was afraid of really is that I had something wrong with me mentally. I really thought I was secretly crazy. And I don't mean crazy. I mean secretly damaged, like really damaged emotionally and mentally. And that terrified me. And I thought, what I really need is not AA. What I really need is a psychiatrist. The problem I had is I didn't have any money, substantial money. I had hundreds of dollars is all I had in my name. And I didn't have any insurance because the type of job I had didn't have benefits. You know, there was no type of job. and so I could not afford a psychiatrist. So I thought, as I'm playing this through in my mind, I thought, well, I could go to like one of these county-appointed therapists or something, right? Counselors, because my parents had been on welfare when I was a little kid down in South Phoenix. I knew that you could get assisted type stuff, so I thought you did. Then I thought, well, if they were any good, they'd be psychiatrists, so why would I go to one of them? You know, because they had to be amateurs if they were doing it, you know, for the county or whatever, so I wouldn't be doing it. And the only thing I knew about AA is it was free. So I thought, well, I'll try AA, because if it doesn't work, I'll still have what little money I have and I can drink. And it's the only reason I tried AA, not because I thought it was an alcoholic, because it was free. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous on the phone through the Yellow Pages and asked them if there was a meeting and where I could go, and they gave me the address and everything. So that night I went to an AA meeting, and I tried to sneak in, I really did. They had it in a Alano Club, do they call them that here? Or Yano Club or something, they call them different things all over the place. But they had it in an Alano Club up in Kennewick, Washington. And I circled the building like two or three times and thought, man, how do you get in there without being noticed, you know? I just didn't want to just walk in and people see me and shit, you know? So I finally found a place about a block away I could hide my car. And I got around to this corner where I could see the club over there. And I just waited. I could see the club, and I waited for people to start gathering up, and this little crowd came. You know, they're going onesie, twosie. But I waited for this little crowd, about six or eight of them, and I kind of fell in behind them. And I thought, well, this is all just kind of going with this little crowd. And my plan was coming off good. Dick D was the greeter at the door, and he was a serious greeter now. He was in front of the door, and you had to shake hands with Dick, or you couldn't get in. You're the big old cowboy guy with big, thick Coke bottle glasses on him, you know, and real gruff, like a movie actor type guy. And Dick shaking hands with everybody. Hi, Bob, how you doing? Hi, Jennifer, nice to see you, kid. And, you know, pulling them in. And I thought when I get to him, he'd just say, how you doing, young fella, or something. And he grabs me by the hand and he said, hi, I'm Dick D, are you new? And I thought, how in the hell did he know? How did he know I was new? And the answer is easy. You can always tell a new guy. You can't tell them much, but you can always tell them. And I know, you know, I stole that line. So, who is it that always used to say that? Who was that? I always thought that was so entertaining when I was young. And but anyway, so Dick grabs me by the hand and he shakes my hand as he pulls me up the stairs, and he takes me. And I thought that's true, you know. He was supposed to stay at the door, but he took me by the hand and he walked me into the meeting a little early, and he sat me down and he went and got me a cup of coffee, and he came back and he sat down next to me. And again, just a little thing that might have saved my life, but Dick brought me in and he sat me down next to him. And we went through the meeting, and I don't have a damn clue what happened. It was a terrible meeting, I suspect, most of them, right? And Dick said, come back tomorrow and to another meeting and I'll meet you here. And of course, like so many of us, I hadn't been invited back anywhere as long as I could remember, if ever. You know, I wasn't. Our sponsor, his grand sponsor, my sponsor, says some people return to normal living when they get sober. And some people like me, he says, talking about me, some people like you get an opportunity at normal living when you get here. There was no normal living ever to return to in my life. And so Dick said, why don't you come back tomorrow night and I'll meet you here. And I came back the next night and Dick was there. He was there and he sat with me and he got me a cup of coffee. And one of the coolest things I thought, because I was so worried about looking bad, you know, when I was new, that I wanted another cup of coffee terribly bad when I was sitting in the meeting, but I was so afraid to do anything about it, so I just get a cup of coffee and sit there. And then somebody got up in the middle of the meeting and they walked over to the coffee pot and filled their coffee cup and came back and sat down, and nobody said anything. They didn't even look at me or nothing. I thought, damn, I wonder if I could do that. I wonder if I could go get a cup. I don't have a clue what they're talking about in sobriety, but I thought maybe I could walk over and get a cup of coffee. And I did. And it was like an amazing thing that I could go in while everybody was doing their thing, and I got my coffee and I came back and I started to like AA. And I was sitting there and Dick was being nice to me. And I still have no idea what anybody said. Just sounded like a bunch of Boy Scout bullshit to me, you know. They're talking about God, which I just tuned out because that's just fantasy, fairy tale bullshit to me. You know, I didn't want to hear none of that. And they talked about steps, and I remember looking at the steps on the wall, and I was kind of deciphering myself, and I thought, well, where in the hell is the step to get your wife off your ass? pass. You know, that's the step I needed. And where's the step for getting the bill collectors and the courts from collecting their alimony? You know, I need that step too. You know, there were no steps for the problems that were current in my life. None of that stuff applied to anything that was going on in my life right now. And when I saw amends and inventory shit, I thought there are a lot of people owe me amends. You know, that's the only thing I can think about. So those steps just didn't seem to have any bearing on what was going on in my life. So I just kind of blew that off. But that's what people talk about. And they talked about sponsorship. And the sponsorship thing interested me because I really came there looking for an answer. I didn't get sent to AA. I didn't get guilted into it or threatened into it. I really went there because I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. You know, I was scared to death. I was mentally deficient. You know, I was looking for some answer. So I went up after that, either the first or second, probably the second meeting, I went up to the leader and after the meeting, because he said during his announcements, which your guys' were very short, which I liked, actually. Clancy would complain, but I would, and I won't tell him as long as you behave yourself. And anyways, so in his announcements, he said something like, you're here at a lot of meetings, if you need sponsors, see me after the meeting, and I'll help you or whatever. He said something like that. So I went up to him after the meeting. Nobody was around, just him. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, how do you get a sponsor? And he turned around. And he took a pamphlet on sponsorship out of a rack. And he handed it to me and he said, find somebody you relate to. And he walked away. And I felt rejected. I felt like I had asked him to sponsor me. Now, mind you, I did not. But it was the best I could do. So if a newcomer ever asks you that question, maybe it's the best he can do. Now, it turns out I'm glad he didn't sponsor me because he turned out to be a shit. I stayed sober that room. He was, would have been a terrible sponsor. But I felt rejected. I felt like he had absolutely crushed my, put myself out there, you know, and just stomped on me. And, you know, I wanted to stab him in the neck. You know, I was devastated by this whole event. And so I decided right then I'll never ask anybody to sponsor me again. Now, keep in mind, I never asked anybody to sponsor me yet, but the way our brains work, you know, I'll never ask anybody to sponsor me again. And that pamphlet on sponsorship, in case you guys are new, I was sponsoring a guy one time for about a year, and he gave me one of those and said, you should read this. And I'm here to report I still never have and won't. But anyways, that's my relationship with the sponsorship pamphlet. So anyways, I come back to another meeting, and I'm sitting in that meeting, and now I'm starting to get a little discouraged. You know, my third AA meeting, you guys have had your chance. And I'm none too impressed, if you all know the truth. And goes around the room, and this old-timer was sitting at the no-smoking table, because I got sober long enough ago, you could still smoke when I got sober. And he was at the no-smoking table over in the corner. And his little ass-kissers all around him, you know, the guys he sponsored and stuff. When it got to him, I don't know anything about the meeting. I don't know anything about the topic or what was said, but I remember him saying this. If your problem is drinking, stop drinking. Put a couple of bucks in the basket when it comes by and tap dance down the road a happy person. But if when you stop drinking, your life gets worse, maybe we can help you. And for the first time in my life, I identified with somebody. And I felt like maybe he knows how I feel. For the first time in my life, he said something that made sense to me. When I stop drinking, my life gets worse. I wish if you could, big book thumpers, plug your ears right now, because I'm going to say something that will be considered a blasphemy. And it's arrogant, because nobody should think this way. But if I could change one thing, in the steps, in the big book, I would change this. Instead of, we were powerless over alcohol that our lives had become unmanageable, I would change that to say, we were powerless over alcohol that our emotions had become unmanageable. I would change that line, because I believe that's what Bill Wilson meant. Powerless over alcohol that our emotions had become unmanageable. That's what was wrong with me. When I got sober, my emotions became completely unmanageable. When I was drinking, the reason I kept drinking is because my emotions were completely unmanageable. And one day, when I'm dead soon, I hope I'm talking with Bill, because I'll be there. No question in my mind. I'm talking with Bill. I'll bet he agrees with me. I'm going to ask him. I mean, when he said that, I identified, like the light went off, and I thought, well, you know, somebody understands how I feel. But I damn sure was still not going to, still wasn't going to talk to anybody because I already made my decision. You know, and when we make a decision, we stick with it no matter how stupid it is, right? And I made a decision. I'm going to ask nobody's functioning. So, plus I scared everybody. And I didn't stick around for the Lord's Prayer. We were talking before the meeting. I was 2 years sober before I would hug anybody. Wouldn't hug anybody, not the girls or the boys. I wasn't touchy like that. You damn well better keep your hands off me, I promise you. I wasn't about all of that bullshit, you know. And because I'd never been to church, I didn't know the words to any of the prayers, and I didn't want anybody to know that I didn't know the words because I didn't want to be embarrassed, because if you embarrassed me, I'd have to get my ass whooped. And that was my M.O. I had to defend myself, you know, and I wasn't very tough. I was a tough guy, but I just wasn't very tough. It's bad to be a tough guy when you're tough. You know? Like I said, I weighed 146 pounds. How tough can you be? It isn't too little. And so when everybody gathered up for the prayer after the first meeting, I figured out what was going to happen. So I sat close enough to the door those first couple of meetings that when everybody stood up and the meeting was over, I could hit the door and leave. So I didn't have to be embarrassed not, you know, having to stand there through the whole thing. So I'm about halfway to my car. And Mickey was his name, my first sponsor. He catches me at the car. And he says, hey, before you leave, let me ask you a question. You want to do some stuff with Rick Rennie? Been sober about 20 years at that time, and he said, have you got a sponsor? And I said, no. He said, great, I'm going to be your sponsor, but there's some things you're going to have to do. And I said, okay. Hell, I was just happy that somebody was taking the control of the thing. I didn't have to put myself out there again, you know, and he did it so fast and controlling, I didn't have a choice anyways, you know. I mean, he just kind of ran up to me, and I said, like what? And he said, well, can you call me every day for a while? And I said, yeah, that'd be easy enough. He said, have you got a big book? And I said, yeah. He said, can you read? And he told me what he wanted me to read in the book. And he just took in with me every day. And I said, yeah, I can do that. And then he said, the fatal thing. He said, do you believe in God? And I said, no. And if I have to for this to work, this won't work for me. And he saved my life because he was a good AA. And he said, well, that's okay. Are you willing to believe in God if I can prove it to you? And I said, yeah, but you won't. He said, good enough. All you need is a willingness. We got all giddy about it, and I thought, Jesus, this is a weird subject, you know. But he was all excited that I had this willingness to believe in God, and then he dropped it. He never bothered me about it again, and I'm so happy for that, because if he'd have pushed me about that, he'd have ran me off. If my cousin wouldn't have told me about the one part A people believe in God and the whole other part people don't, that first meeting, they were talking about God. I promise you, if he hadn't have told me that, I'd have left. I promise you I would. I'd have died proving I was right before I'd have subjected myself to that. But I'm sitting in this meeting thinking, I wonder where the one for the atheist is. you don't walk up to anybody and ask them that in a meeting. You know what you do, but I sit there thinking, I wonder where the willingness of the atheist is. And well, I'll find it in time. You know, if I stick around here long enough, I'll find the angle on it, right? Anyway, so Mickey started working with me. And Mickey was my sponsor for 12 years. And he, I was about 12 years sober when he died. And he was a wonderful sponsor. He was fabulous. The only time we ever had an issue is we got to the third step prayer in the big book. And he wanted me to read that prayer. And I believe he asked me to get down on my knees and hold hands with him and say this prayer. He owned this business where he sold fax machines and copiers and stuff, which... And, you know, like the phones with the faxes on them, that was his business. And then in the back, he had this repair shop where if one of them broke, he brought it in and he'd work on it. And we're back in the repair shop. Doors locked, business is closed. And he wants me to get down on my knees and hold hands with him and say a prayer. And I'm thinking, there's going to be a killing tonight, you know, because I'm in the back room with this old man. This is just going to be bad. And I said, no, obviously. I said, I'm not doing that. I mean, there was no thought about it. He said, that shit. I said, no, I'm not doing that. And he said, why not? I said, I told you I don't believe in God. And he said, well, you said you were willing to take the steps and follow the instructions, and that's what it says in the book. And I said, I don't give a shit. shit what it says. I'm not saying a prayer, and I'm damn sure not getting down on my hands and knees. And he says, I want you on your hands and knees, and not his dog either. So I presented all this shit. So anyways, he gets mad at me. The only time he ever got mad at me, he got mad at me, and he started raising his voice a little bit, and I stood my ground, and finally he said, oh, shit. Will you just read the damn thing so at least you can say you did it? And I said, I'll read it because it's all. And I flipped over to it, and I read it with gritted teeth and done. Bam, I shut the book and said, there, it didn't do a damn thing for me. And he said, let's just move on. Let's just move on, he said. And he told me how to write an inventory. And I wrote this inventory. And I was reading in the big book, you know, where it said, you know, once you're ready to share this inventory with somebody, that you, you know, you got the way I perceived it at that time. You find somebody you trust enough that you can tell them all the stuff that you swore you'd never tell nobody. You know? And I didn't even know what those things were that I was keeping in. But as I was reading that, all of a sudden, two or three things popped into my brain. And I thought, oh, shit. Is that what they're talking about? Those are the things I got to talk about to somebody. And I thought, well, I ain't talking to him. I've known him 3 weeks. I am not telling him this stuff, and he's from Canada, for Christ's sake. How much can you trust a guy from Canada, right? And so anyways, I'm reading in the book where it said this is a place where it's okay to postpone it until you find the right person. And I knew this guy who owned a tire, or who was a union construction worker, and I owned a tire store for a little while. That's a whole other story. I had to give that up when I got sober because I found out you cannot sell stolen merchandise and stay sober. That was a devastating discovery for me. And the problem with my tire store is if I was not stealing the tires, the margin was not good enough to cover my rent and shit. If you had to actually pay for them and then be competitive with the other competition, you just didn't make enough money and the math didn't work. I had to close my tire store. That's all I'm doing. Anyway, so I don't know what I got off track on that there. But anyway, so this customer of mine, I'd gotten to be friends with, and he'd seen me through my drink. As a matter of fact, he'd come in my store sometimes and found me drunk in my store, incapable of functioning, put me in the car, locked my store up so people wouldn't rob me and just take me home. I'd be too drunk to work. And so, I mean, we were pretty good friends. When I got sober, he was damn sure glad to see me sober and thought I needed to be. And here I am now, about 5 months sober. That's 4 months sober before I ever went to my first AA meeting. I'm about 5 months sober. And I called this guy and I said, hey, you know, I'm doing this thing in AA, and he said, yeah, I'm glad for that. You need to be. He said, I'm doing this thing in AA, and, you know, just find somebody you trust, and I trust you, and there's some things that it tells me I'm going to have to do. And I just kind of told him what the book told me to do, and I'd already written this inventory because Mickey had told me how, but I didn't put that shit on it. I promise you that. None of that was written down. I didn't even know I was supposed to write that down. And because it wasn't the type of stuff that I would ever even consider talking to somebody about. And so I told him to talk to somebody. He said, okay. So he met me in the parking lot of McDonald's in his psychedelic Pinto station wagon. And I'm sitting in the passenger side of his psychedelic Pinto station wagon, and I've got my inventory here, but none of this stuff's on it, you know. And he said, so what do you want to talk about? And I said, well, I said, man, I'm just, there's some things I've been carrying around, and I think it's what they're talking about. So it's keeping me wanting to keep getting drunk. And he said, well, just tell me what it is. So I couldn't look at him. I'm looking out the window, and I just said it out loud, and I started to bawl. I couldn't control it either. I mean, I just broke down into tears, and I mean, I was just devastated, absolutely beside myself that I had said that out loud to another human being. I couldn't believe it. I told somebody what a lousy piece of shit I really was, and I couldn't stop it. I mean, I just can't. And I had not cried since I was 9 years old, maybe. You could beat me to death and I wouldn't cry. I was just that angry, you know. And matter of fact, Mickey, my first sponsor, said until the day he died that I was the angriest newcomer he had ever seen come into AA. I don't know if that was true, but I know he believed it was true. He'd been sober 20 years when he met me and said, so the angriest newcomer he'd ever seen. But I could not believe that I had said that out loud. And I finally, after minutes of uncontrollable, you know, just, I kind of gathered myself up a little bit, and I looked over to see if he was still in the car. I couldn't look at him. I just couldn't see him. He's sitting there, and he was fine. He said, well, you know, I never did have a situation like that happen to me when I was a kid, but when I was in college, I got to work one time when Taylor got me, told me this story. didn't even really relate to what had happened to me. But I remember feeling like, well, maybe it's okay that I told him that. You know, I mean, I didn't even have any conscious thought. Just maybe something would be okay. And he said, what else you got? So I told him another thing. And that wasn't so bad either. And I had one more thing to tell him. I told him that. And I thought, and he told me a couple stories. And we talked for a little while. And I got in my car and drove off. And I'm heading home. I got about a 45-minute drive home. I remember driving home thinking, and you got to remember, I was a devout atheist at that point. I'd fight you over it. I was so committed to it. I remember driving home thinking, I feel pretty good. I didn't even know you could feel this good. I wonder if it's even possible to feel as good as I feel. I mean, the relief was so unbelievable. And I drive a little while further and I thought, damn, I feel good. God, I'm so glad I did that. I drive a little further and I thought, I just wonder if maybe there really is a God. Because for me to feel this good, there has to be something. Now that was just a spark. It was just a maybe that there could be just a little tiny bit of surrender to the idea that maybe there was a God. But it was enough to get me started. I got with Mickey and told him I did my inventory. He said, I don't give a shit what you did. I'm your sponsor. And if you want me to keep sponsoring, you got to share your inventory with me. And I won't sponsor you. And I said, well, shit, it didn't go bad with him. So, all right. So I just told him that wasn't a big. So we did it. But the nice thing about doing my sponsor, once I got those secrets out, wasn't that big a deal to tell him. And he was able to give me some helpful return information on that too. But then we went through the list of the angers and fears and the sex conduct and all of that stuff and really give me some practical, structured way to move forward, you know, and learn something about that. And I really did do what his sponsor was, that was uncover and discover the truth about me. That's what I did through that process and who I really was. And then he helped me through the rest of the steps. But as time went on, he started to, every time I would mention God, he would laugh at me and say, you said God.
He thought I was afraid to say, you know, because I was just so mean about it. And I said, ah, screw off, you know. And with Nicky, we had such a, why are you taking your knife out?
It's Jerry's, and I'm wondering why he's such a killer.
All right. But the story was going bad. It was just going bad.
I'm going to shake you if you don't watch out.
Anyways, so Mickey and I just developed such a kind and loving relationship. And he was the first man in my life that I ever loved. And I just absolutely loved him. He was just such a kind man. And he spent so much time that he didn't have to spend with me. And we just developed such a good relationship. And stayed in close contact with him, even... you know, even after when I was 2 years sober there, I moved back to Arizona because I was ready to face my alimony and child support and be a good dad to my daughter, who I had with my ex-wife. So my wife and I relocated to Arizona and got involved in the group down there and kept calling Mickey, called him every week for 10 years after that till he died and was a good dad. And then my current wife, the woman from the bar that I got drunk with and married while I was divorced, and the other one got pregnant and I had a son. And he was born right about when I got sober. So neither one of my kids ever remembered me. My daughter was alive when I was drinking the last few years, but she was too little to remember any of it. So I was able to raise my kids in sobriety. And when I was, and I just loved my children loved me. And I turned out, through the help of AA, to be a pretty good dad. You know, I mean, I was a terrible dad, but I was a pretty good dad because I loved him and I did my best. And that anger and that violence, violent nature of mine carried on for years into my sobriety. It took a long time for me to quit, you know, yelling at people. And I'm almost over it. Any day now, I don't feel like it. But anyways... Clancy was talking the other day about chasing somebody down the freeway, and he said, I never chase anybody down the freeway that cuts me off anymore past my exit. Yeah, 58 years. Yeah, we get better. It's going to take a while. But anyway, so when I was about 6 years sober, I bring a guy home. I'm sponsoring a bunch of guys. I'm very active in AA. And met Clancy, and I was 2 years sober because him and Mickey were good friends, and they traveled around speaking together. And so I was at Clancy's every year, you know, so I got to know him very well. And so I'm sponsoring a bunch of people, and we have a speaker speaker meeting in this town in Arizona. We had about 200 people every Tuesday night, and it was a Pacific Group meeting, and one of Clancy's babies had retired, moved there, and started it, so it was like this. It just had grown and got bigger and bigger, and so I bring one of my guys home, a new guy that I'm sponsoring, to a picnic at my house or barbecue, and he hits it off with my wife, and within a few months, they're having an affair, and so the marriage starts to, you know, be at risk, and I want you to know it took a while, but I finally quit sponsoring him. Anyways, that marriage ended, and that was hard on me because, you know, I'd always been such a shit that I didn't deserve anything good to happen to me. When bad things happen, I just expected it. But I'd been sober for 6 years, and I was a good guy. I'd been on the same job, you know, for 4 years now. I've been on the same job, and I bring a paycheck home every week, and I come home, and I do all the right stuff, and I'm loyal and faithful, and I'm a good husband and a good dad and all that stuff. And then here she goes and has an affair with some guy that's watching in AA. How is that supposed to happen? Why is that supposed to be okay? You know? And so I'm questioning the shit out of that. That's just not right, you know. And it got me off track a little bit. I didn't really get mad at AA or anything. I did think about killing him a couple of times, but I hate myself because I called my sponsor and he said, if you kill him, you're going to go to prison. If you want to go to prison, go kill him. I said, well, I don't want to go to prison. He said, why don't you just stay the hell away from me? You can't control what she's going to do. He helped work me through that. It ended in divorce. But I stayed in very close contact with my son. I'll wrap this up. I'm sorry. I stayed in very close contact with my son. And about, I don't know, about 3 years in, just staying steady in AA, just keep doing the right stuff. We wound up getting through that divorce and keeping an amicable relationship. And because my son was so important to me, he was just such a love of my life. You know, I wanted to stay close to him. I didn't want to ruin it. And then I met my current wife, Shelly, and she had two boys, and I had my daughter from my first marriage who lived right there too, and my son from that marriage. And so I used to tell people I had so many kids from so many different marriages on Sunday after they'd all visit, the doorbell would ring, and I'd line all the kids up and say, okay, when I open the door, tell me which one of you belonged to her. And the kids used to think that's hilarious. None of the ex-wives ever thought that was him. Anyways, so she brought two little kids, little boys, into the relationship, and I bought two, so we finished raising four of them. And I raised her kids like they were mine, and she raised my kids like they were hers. And my son, Gus, he called her Mama too. She was Mama too. He just loved her too. But I continued to go through, you know, recovered from that divorce and got remarried, and my wife and I have been married 16 years now. We have the best relationship of any two people I know in this world. Absolutely better than me. I wouldn't trade my life for anybody. My relationship to God just kept growing and growing, and I spent about 15 years studying religion because I wanted to find mine. Now that I started believing there was a God, where do I fit? You know, am I going to be a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist or a Scientologist or a Mormon? Or, you know, where am I going to fit into this thing? So I started studying religion. Didn't want to admit to anybody still that I didn't know anything about it. I spent 15 years doing that, and I went to the Jewish synagogue, and I went to Catholic Mass, and I went to the Buddhist temple, and I went to all of these different, you know, religious functions and churches and ceremonies, and tried to find my place. And I finally realized after 15 years of that that AA is my church. And I'm happy with that today. And I will attend church with anybody, and I'll attend any church, because I never had any prejudice against any church because I was not raised Christian. So I looked down on other churches. I was not raised as a Jew. So I looked down on Christians and, you know, their beliefs. And I wasn't raised that way. They all looked the same to me. So I studied all of them with the same open mind. And the thing I came to understand through that 15 years of study is that if you take all the man-made ritual off the top, you just remove all of that stuff, the basic message in every religion is exactly the same: to love each other and to do unto others. And don't lie and steal. Don't cheat. Don't be a shit, right? Be a good person. And it's the same basic message through every one of them. They just have different rituals that they put on top of it and ways that they get there. But after 15 years, I was like Forrest Gump, you know, running across the country and then running back and running back. And finally, one day, he said, I'm tired and done. And after 15 years, I was tired. I absolutely could not read another book on religion. If it just would save my life, I wouldn't do it. I'm so tired of reading all the stuff. I couldn't tell you how many hundreds of books I read over the years. And I'm done. I've learned all I'm willing to learn. God, if there's more, you're just going to have to show it to me because I'm tired of looking. And I surrendered at a level that I had never surrendered at before. About a year later, through that surrender, something happened to me that I can't explain, and anybody who's ever had a religious experience would explain it. I'm 18 years sober when this happens to me, so I'm a little bit of a slow getter, I promise you. I'm 18 years sober, but something happened to me to make me absolutely know, with no question in my mind, that there is a loving God that loves me. And the coolest thing, He loves me exactly the same as He loves you. And He loves you exactly the same as He loves me. And it is the only thing in our existence that's fair. But it is absolutely fair. Absolutely fair. And I know it with no question in my being that it's true. So it was put to the test on December 10th, a year ago. Not this last December, but a year ago. My youngest son was brutally murdered in Mobile, Alabama. At South University, he was dating a young girl whose ex lost his mind, shot my son 5 times and shot the girl 8 times, killed them both, and then shot himself in the head and killed himself. And devastating to our family, I promise you, because this boy loved his daddy, and he loved Mama too. If he came to my house on the weekends when I was home, he would, you know, to do his laundry or mooch food out of the fridge or what kids do, you know, he'd just come over on the weekends. If he came in at 10 o'clock in the morning, he wouldn't leave without kissing me, telling me that he loved me. And if he came back 2 o'clock in the afternoon, horsed around, did whatever, he wouldn't leave without kissing me and telling me that he loved me. Every time he was ever around me, when he left, he kissed me and he told me he loved me. And he did love me. Absolutely loved me with every ounce of his being. And when I lost him, it was such a devastating event. But the coolest thing, thanks to AA, not once ever did I question God. Not once ever did I question God's fairness and God's love. I knew immediately what I had preached to the guys I sponsored for so many years. You can't worry about your kids. They're not your kids. They're God's kids. We just get the privilege of hanging out with them and playing with them while we're here. That's it. They're God's kids. The second he died, and they told me he died, I was devastated, but I knew he was with his father, and I knew he was okay. And I'm so glad that I got to spend time with him while he was here. Thank you.